Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today, once again, we convene the Science Forum, and we've gathered a panel of scientific experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Facebook, if you like, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You'll see a Vox Pop post there. Tweet us at WAMC Radio using the hashtag Vox Pop, or email voxpop@wamc.org, or call 1-800-348-2551. Back 600-700 years ago, these guys would have been burnt at the stake, but today we'll just talk to them. They're scientists, don't you know? And scientists, please sign in.
Ed Stander, Sunny Kobolskill, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and today I will be channeling Barbara Brabets, who is presently flying in from South Carolina and can't be here.
Well, that's unacceptable.
I'm Jim Pickett, after all of the things that Ed does. I'm just an organic chemist.
Okay.
Recently retired from GE Global Research.
How's the retirement working out for you?
It's very nice.
You look very relaxed.
I am much more relaxed.
Although I think most scientists who I've seen on the show are generally fairly loose. Mm. You know, relaxed.
That's because we know better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ed especially would be Exhibit A. He's loose. Let's go right to the phones. Kellen in Queensbury. Kellen, you're on.
I'm very interested in cosmology, and I was wondering, if light is not made of matter, how do black holes redirect the way and the direction that light travels?
Curved space, right?
That's right. I mean, light, to say whether light has mass or not is a very ambiguous thing to my mind anyway. I'm sure a physicist would be able to straighten it out a little better. The fact is that it is classified as a massless particle, because if it wasn't massless, it wouldn't be able to travel the speed of light. Nevertheless, it has attributes that we would attribute to mass, in that it is attracted toward massive objects by gravity. And that can be explained by that it's following a straight line and space is curved. That's the other way to think about it.
Yeah.
So the mass of the black hole curves space so strongly that the photon turns around and goes back in.
Yeah, and that was first discovered, by the way, by looking at Jupiter. And what happens on Jupiter is that the moons go behind Jupiter every once in a while, and we can figure out pretty well exactly when it should go behind. And if Jupiter is on the same side of the sun as we are, then the moon Europa, for example, goes behind Jupiter exactly the right time. But if Jupiter is on the other side of the sun, so that the light has to go by the sun and then reach us, it takes a little bit longer. And the reason for that is that the light is actually following the curvature that's produced by the sun itself, curvature of space. So if you can imagine, it's not walking a straight line from Europa to us, it's walking a straight line, bending down into that gravity well, and then coming back up again. So effectively what it's doing is it's staying within space-time as such, but because space-time is curved, the amount of time it takes changes. And in the case of a black hole, it's such a large gravity well that it actually, things will fall into it, simply because it's the curvature is extreme.
Okay. So the energy that is contained within light can be curved by such massive gravity.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Kellen. We appreciate the call very much. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. We're joined today by Ed Stander and Jim Pickett. So, Jim, if a photon is, in fact, a particle.
Yep.
It has to have some mass, right? It can't be a particle. There's a wave function to light.
Yep.
And there seems to be some quantum question about how they switch from a wave function to a particle without mass.
Yes. If you think about it too much, you will cause your brain to melt.
Okay. We may be a little late on that.
Yeah, that's why I kind of just accept. There's certain things in science that you either have to be really, really, really smart and understand, or you just sort of accept it and move on.
And of course, what's true in science today is not true in science tomorrow in any case. There's an article that just came out that suggests that this idea of dark matter, something out there that's making things come together, may not exist, and that actually the laws
of gravity are not as we suspect. So very far away, there's an inverse effect of what they would expect,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Einstein said that things work very well, you know, on a square piece of paper. Isaac Newton said that. And then Einstein said, well, it does work, except the paper's curved. And it's very possible that if you take a large enough piece of paper, that there's something else going on that neither Einstein nor Newton experienced or expected. So it's very possible that when you're talking about things on the galactic scale, for example, maybe the speed of light doesn't stay constant. It's things vary over very large scales, which don't necessarily do it on small scales.
You know, regarding dark matter, it seems that sometimes science will get into a mob mentality. Now, dark matter was all the rage, and there was no way of proving it, you could see effects of something that, well, dark matter could be causing that. But everybody jumped on the bandwagon, and it may not be.
Oh,
it's certainly counterintuitive that it would exist, but that doesn't mean anything.
Well, dark matter is a placeholder in any case,
yeah,
just like dark energy. It's something that may be there or it may not be there, but in the meantime, we have a square, and if we ever find it, we'll know what to call it.
I mean, the neutrinos, which which surely exist, would have been a really good candidate for dark matter, except there just doesn't seem to be enough of them. Because
right.
They interact only very feebly with regular matter.
Hmm.
There's no reason why there couldn't be other stuff like that.
Right, and neutrinos are placeholders as well. I mean, we don't know what they are. We have no clue.
Okay, so we start with the fact that we have no clue. Let's go to another phone call. And Wolfgang in Pownall, Vermont. Wolfgang, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Listen, I've been thinking about the issues of global warming and heat exchanges in the atmosphere, and something that never gets mentioned is how we're changing the heat balance by increasing the amount of reflectivity on the surface of the Earth all the time. And I was wondering, because this has come up now, what is the relative increase in reflectivity of heat going back into the atmosphere when you put in a solar field where there used to be a farm field before, where all that energy was basically getting absorbed or significantly getting absorbed by the field and growing vegetation versus bouncing off the surface of a solar panel? Obviously, some of the energy gets absorbed, but a lot of it goes back. And I was just wondering if anybody had done the calculation to figure out what change that makes in the reflectivity and how much heat additional you're putting back by building a solar field.
I think you'll find that the solar panel reflects less light than anything surrounding it. Sort of by definition, they have to be black. There will be reflection off the front surface, just like there is reflection off the surface of any glass. That'll be 4 or 5% of the light. But the any kind of Earth surface of grass or stones or anything is going to reflect a lot more than that.
Very interesting.
So basically what you're doing with the solar panel is
absorbing.
You're absorbing, and all of that energy gets converted to electricity or heat, and then the electricity eventually gets converted to heat.
And another comment on that as well is that the amount of reflectivity associated with solar panels pales compared to, for example, clouds. Any number of other things on the surface that are reflecting enormous amounts. In fact, one of the things that people have discovered when they're working with global warming is that as the number of clouds increases as a result of the temperature, it actually reflects more out to space.
Like
so
Venus.
It's a moderating effect, exactly.
But yet Venus is 900 degrees or more than that.
That has a lot more carbon dioxide than we have.
Okay, at this time.
At this time.
Yeah. All right. Wolfgang, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Jim, you wanted to say something else about that?
Nope.
All right. Let's go to line one and Joshua in New Lebanon. Joshua, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my call there. I got kind of a two-part question here, a little bit of chemistry and a little bit of physics. I'm working on a degree in environmental science myself, so I was hoping you guys could elaborate for me. Okay. I realize this is a controversial issue. But my question has to do with the collapse of the Twin Towers. The National Institute of Standards and Technology released a report stating that the South Tower collapsed in approximately 9 seconds. Now, I've studied this fairly extensively. The height of that tower was 1,368 feet. And my understanding, using a fairly simple formula that was introduced to me called Galileo's Law of Falling Bodies, states that for any object to fall that height in that amount of time, it would have to encounter pretty much zero resistance. In other words, literally indistinguishable from free fall in a vacuum.
Okay. Hey, Joshua,
so,
can you just hang?
Sir.
Can you? We got to take a break here. Can you hang on the line and then we'll come back?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we'll take a short break for underwriting. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support comes from the Honest Weight Food Co-op in Albany, New York, hosting a public strategic planning event, honestweight.coop/community events for details. Flurry Lumber, Route 10 East Hampton, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large. Items such as Benjamin Moore paints, hardwood flooring, Anderson windows, Trex decking, tools, lumber, hardware. FlurryLumber.com. SPAC, presenting the Mormon Tabernacle Choir's 360-member ensemble and 68-person orchestra, performing one night, Monday, June 29th. SPAC.org for events and tickets. And Poughkeepsie Farm Project, connecting food, farm, and community, organically grown CSA shares still available for the full season, June through mid-November, farmproject.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Joshua in New Lebanon was on the line, and just give us a quick recap of what you said, and then carry on, Joshua.
Yes, sir. Okay. So my question was, is that, like I said, my understanding is that for any object to fall the height of the South Tower, being 1,368 feet, in approximately 9 seconds, which was the distance quoted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, you know, it would have to encounter zero resistance. And my understanding is, according to some of the structural engineers, that that building had over 100,000 tons of steel in its structural system. So how is it that it managed to fall in that short amount of time when it clearly should have encountered far more resistance than air?
Well, I think the answer is pretty simple, and that's that it took longer than 9 seconds to fall. The trick is that as it started to fall, if you remember the pictures, the entire area got totally clouded up by the concrete dust and all the rest that filled the air. So it's impossible to tell when the top of the tower reached the bottom. So first thing I would do is check to see how they actually measured when it fell and how they were able to determine that from the time of start to the time of impact took 9 seconds.
All right. You had a part two, Joshua?
Yeah. Well, my second question is part chemistry. You know, molten steel was also documented at the base of all three towers, including Building 7 that fell. And my understanding is that steel simply won't begin to melt until about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And, you know, as we all know, kerosene was blamed, or jet fuel, for adding a lot of heat to the structure. And you know, that caused a structural collapse. So my understanding, and I'll wrap this up, is that kerosene can only reach about 1,800 degrees. And, I mean, that's being very generous with a controlled burn. So how could that account for the molten steel that was documented by both FEMA and Controlled Demolition Incorporated, one of the contractors that was called in to help clean up the mess?
Well, perhaps during the time that it was falling, it would be like putting, for example, the way that blacksmiths get hot enough to be able to work iron is to pump air into the into the charcoal. As the structure is falling, it's going to be creating a wind.
Moving air. Interesting.
And perhaps that heated it up. There may also be a matter of the physical working of the steel is going to add some heat, but I don't know how much that would be.
Well, Joshua, thanks a lot for the call. Ed, you want to follow up?
Oh, just the other comment I could have, and I'm thinking about it, is that steel can undergo phase changes depending on the amount of pressure that's put on it. And when this thing starts to fall down, I don't know this for a fact, but it's quite possible that not only do you have the temperature, but you have a pressure effect as well.
Ah, okay. And it's a lot of pressure, one would assume.
From 100,000 tons of steel falling on top of itself, yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of potential energy that's going to go to heat.
Into heat.
All right, let's go to Barry in Scotia. Barry, you're on.
I'm going to ask my question and then get off.
Okay.
Listening to things about Sir Stephen Hawking's, one general question was, you know, what was his contribution? I know he's talking about the beginning of the end of the universe, but did he actually contribute to the theory of black holes? But the general question is, I understand the universe is 94% nothing. That is no atoms, no gas, liquid, solids. So one part of that is, does the time-space continuum or any kind of space exist in this 94% of the universe? And the second one is, what is the relationship of black holes, dark energy, and dark matter to this 94%? Is there more nothingness out there, or is that largely about the 94%? Those are my questions. Thank you.
All right, Barry, thanks a lot. Okay, go ahead, gentlemen.
Go for it, Ed.
I'm just going to relax.
Well, we're talking about things that we don't know. We don't know, first of all, the 94% of matter that we don't know about comes from the fact that when you look at it, originally came from the fact that Margaret Geller looked at a bunch of galaxies. Maybe it was Margaret Geller. Anyway, looked at a bunch of galaxies and found that they rotated as fast on the outside of the galaxy as on the inside of the galaxy. And based on that, she argued that the mass, take, for example, the solar system. The sun's in the center of the solar system, and as you go away from the center, things move slower. For example, Pluto takes 243 years to go around, and the Earth takes 365 days.
Yeah.
So that is what's called Keplerian motion, and that's what we believed galaxies did. But we found that instead, they moved the same speed as you went out, and that suggested right off the bat that there was something out there that was holding it all together, and the mass wasn't in the center, it was on the outside. Just recently, we've discovered a huge amount of hydrogen gas around the Andromeda galaxy, like 90 times more gas than we expected to find there.
Right.
And so we do have information that there are things out there that we can't see.
So in other words, what was once thought to be nothing may not in fact be nothing.
It may be nothing, or it may be a change in the physics of a system when it gets too large.
Okay.
So we do know that things move the way they do. We don't know why they do that, and we come up with these ideas of dark matter and dark energy to make it happen.
All right.
But we don't really know what's going on yet.
Well, Barry, thank you for that one. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. Jim Pickett and Ed Stander are here to answer your questions, however large or small they may be. This one from email. This is from somebody just known as R. R. Pirate, obviously. R.
One R or several R's?
One right here.
Okay.
We just saw two devastating earthquakes in Nepal. Many people lost their lives. Why is there no early warning system for earthquakes? And a second question, could the gas industry's practice of hydrofracking put us in danger of possible earthquakes? So two questions, quite different.
Quite the same. As far as Nepal goes, yes, we do have ways of determining when an earthquake is going to occur. Usually what we have to do, though, in order to determine that is measure the stress in the rocks. In other words, for example, over a line that's an earthquake zone, we put a marker, we put another markers on the other side, and we see that they're starting to move and the pressures are building up. You have to have that kind of equipment to be able to do those measurements. And you also have to have people who spend their time to do it.
Yeah, but how far and with how much accuracy can you predict an earthquake?
Well, we can do a pretty good job in a place like California, where we're measuring it all the time, and we have the University of California down there doing the measurements.
Yeah, but if you say 5 minutes from now, hey, the big one's coming.
Well, in some cases you can. For example, in China, the 1970s, there were all sorts of predictors of an earthquake. For example, there were a bunch of horses that started to get very antsy. There were snakes coming out of the ground in the middle of winter. There was water coming out of wells. And as a result, they cleared this area of people, and that night there was an earthquake.
Mm.
And then 10 years later, the horses were asleep, the stakes stayed in the ground, there was a big earthquake, and 24,000 people died. So it really all depends on whether your things are set up to be able to tell it. When an earthquake is going to occur, sometimes it's because the rocks are cracking and the pressure is building up because certain parts of the earthquake zone are failing. Mm. And when that happens, then you get waves coming out of that. And you can predict, you can see those waves, and they start to get more and more, and then you get the people out of there. So in some cases, it's possible. But if the pressure builds up and the rock remains strong, and then it snaps, there's really nothing you can do.
To predict.
In the case of Nepal, we knew there were going to be earthquakes, and we know there's going to be more earthquakes. India's smashing into China. And
well, you don't know when.
No, but the fact is that it's happening.
Right. I know the sun's going to be a red giant at some point and engulf the Earth.
And we have a pretty good idea that's 4.5 billion years from now.
Okay, but...
So we're okay for the moment.
We know that within the next 1,000 years, there will be some more earthquakes in Nepal. It's not really a prediction. It just sort of is what it is, right?
Right. Well, we could predict if we put the equipment there to be able to do it, to, at least to some extent. But it's going to happen anyway. And
yeah.
Where are you going to go? In the case of the Nepal earthquake, it expected a huge area, and it's really difficult to do anything about it.
Hmm.
And I think on the second part of the question about fracking,
mm-hmm.
In my reading about this, it is not so much the fracking itself, it is the long-term disposal of the fracking water by deep well injection, that it's these deep well injection.
And these are relatively shallow earthquakes we're talking about here, right? As opposed to the ones
right.
in Nepal, which yeah. were very, very far down.
No, yes. The ones in Nepal were 14 kilometers, I believe, which yeah. is not far at all.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the range of a really deep earthquake?
300, 400 kilometers.
Really? They go that far down?
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. George in Amherst, Mass. George, you're on.
Hi, guys. My question is about the distinction between Newton's theory of gravity and general relativity. My question is simply that I understand that there's this discussion of forces in Newtonian mechanics and relating it to the other fundamental forces of the universe. But in general relativity, Einstein comes along and says, no, it's because space is curved because of masses and so on. Why isn't the conclusion at that point, okay, that means gravity is not a force, and simply settles the question of why we can't integrate gravity into the other forces of the universe?
Well, boy, I sure wish we had a physicist here today, huh?
Yeah.
I can tell you that, yes, gravity appears to be a curvature of space-time, and as such, it's not a force on a large scale. However, if you want to define what the effect of gravity is on something, then gravity can be defined as a force.
And there's the weak force in this?
Okay.
Not in this case.
But my distinction is that my understanding of forces, like the electromagnetic force, the exchange of the forces is because of photons. But as far as I know, there's nothing been detected, and that seems to me to be a clue that there's anything exchanged at the scale you're talking about. So it seems to be another clue that, in fact, gravity is not a force.
All I can go by is the fact that a lot of really smart physicists
right.
are still trying to reconcile it as a force.
Yeah.
And my reading on a lot of these the physics questions is that there's more than one way that you can look at a number of these problems.
Uh-huh.
What's the right one?
Well, there may be no right one.
Not fair. I mean,
no.
That's a cop-out.
Oh, yeah. But it's like, well, we were, Ray and I were talking earlier about light. Was it a wave or a particle? And you can get perfectly good explanations either way, depending on the phenomenon that you're looking at.
Right,
and
right.
I think gravity is the same
okay.
thing.
Right,
depending on how you're looking at the problem, you approach it mathematically differently.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, George. We appreciate the call. Let's go over to Kay in Ackard. Kay, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I want to go back to the question about dark matter for a minute, because I've always been fascinated by dark matter, and I'm a total amateur, but I had this faint suspicion that maybe it was not actually dark matter at all. And I'm wondering what the results are that you talked about that made people think that it possibly doesn't really exist.
Long time ago, somebody thought there's a formula, probably the most famous formula in physics, which is force equals mass times acceleration. And if you use that formula to try and figure out things on a very large scale, it may not work. Somebody suggested at one point that force equals mass times acceleration squared on a very, very, very large scale. And if that's true, or, you know, to the 1.5 power or whatever, if it's true, then you can explain a lot of the phenomena that you see, for example, in galaxies. Basically, that's where the idea came from. Now, it can't be proven, of course, because we haven't been there. But there are other, as Jim said, there are all sorts of different ways of looking at the same problem. And one of the problems we have right now, I think, as scientists, is that a lot of us have jumped on bandwagons rather than thinking out of the box and thinking that other things may be true. We believe in dark energy right now because, for some reason, the universe appears to be accelerating rather than decelerating like we thought it should. And it may be true, but it may also be true that distances in space varied over time, that the reason that it seems to be accelerating right now is because space has been compressed a bit, or maybe the speed of light has changed. Mm. So these are things that if you told a physicist this, he'd tell you you were totally out to lunch and you might as well go have another beer. But on the other hand, there are also possibilities that have to be explored. And as of right now, very few people are exploring them, although they're out there.
And as Ed said, the concepts of dark matter and dark energy really are placeholders. They have those names because no one knows what they are, or even if they are.
Right.
They're a loose end. They're something that's not explained.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah. But what if you are in a situation as scientists where you cannot test something, string theory, let's say?
Mm-hmm.
So how is it more than just a mental game, a mental exercise?
Well, it's a pyramid structure. You try and develop a foundation and you build on it to see whether everything holds true. And if it does hold true, then you've got a theory that works. But it's always going to be a theory no matter what. For example, string theory, what you're attempting to do is explain a phenomenon through mathematics and then do interpretation based on that or inferences based on that and then see if those are true. So you go the next step and next step until something falls apart and the whole thing drops to the floor and you start over again.
Hmm.
But that's how science works, and that's one of the fun things about it.
So science can be done when something cannot be tested.
Science could always be done, but it may always remain a theory.
But is it science?
Science is theories. And those theories build on each other to make a structure that may or may not even exist.
So when they said in the old days the moon is made of green cheese, then that's science until it's disproven?
Until it's disproven, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, if it's the best that you've got.
Okay. Well, all right. It's the best I got. The best I got is going back to the phones. Paul in Massachusetts. Paul, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My question is, and it might be rather simple for the panel here, but I've often wondered, what is the relationship between the age of the universe, the Big Bang, and the measurable size of the universe today as we know it? It seems to me it doesn't quite match up, and I'm not quite sure how to measure it, but that was my question.
Could you explain that a little bit more? Did you catch that?
I think one of the thinking about the expansion of the universe, you cannot think of it as like a ball growing. Doesn't work like that because it. Again, this is out of my depth because this is hardcore physics. you have to, it's easier to, it's probably better to imagine it growing into a fourth dimensional space. And that causes your brain to melt.
Yes, it does.
And so it is not, it's like the question of, well, if the universe is expanding, what's it expanding into? It's not expanding into anything. The universe is everything, and it's a matter that the space between stuff is getting larger. So no one knows how big the universe is. We know what the size of the observable universe is, but the universe could, in fact, be infinite. No one has the faintest idea of how big the universe is, because we know that there's a lot that we can't see beyond the theoretical observable point.
Oh, boy. Can't we get a biology question on this program?
Well, I hope not.
Hey, Paul, we're going to take a break here. So I appreciate the call, but we are up against a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back on the Vox Pop Science Forum.
Support comes from Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ask for a biology question. We get one, and it's on line two. We'll get to it in a moment. 1-800-348-2551 is our number here. This one came via Facebook from Alex. After years and years of genetically mutated fruit, why don't I have a cherry the size of an apple?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, is that almost all fruit started off really small, and as it's gotten bigger, it's gotten less tasty. So you take a strawberry, for example. The original strawberries were about a quarter of an inch in size.
How long ago?
You can still get them, of course, if you go out in the woods.
Yeah.
And you get a new one, and the big ones are the same same amount of taste in a larger space. So until they come up with a way of doing that, I don't see any reason to do it.
So you're not answering the question.
Well, no, I don't want to. It's a biology question.
All right. It'll just take time, right? And eventually cherries will be the size of watermelon?
Well, they're talking about grapes now. We're making bigger grapes and better tasting as well. So they are coming up with things, but I don't know what it's going to mean.
All right, and then this one came in. One of your students said, I don't have a question. I just wanted to say hi to Professor Stander. I had him as my geology professor in SUNY Cobleskill about 10 years ago. He made the class very fun and educational, and I enjoy listening to him on the Science Forum whenever he's on. So hi, Prof. Hope all is well. That's from Luke, class of 2006.
Oh, thanks, Luke. I needed that.
Is there an outstanding piece of work that you still have to grade for Luke, or is just being nice?
I think I can still raise his grade for another 2 or 3 years.
No, fair enough. Well, well done. Let's go to Kathy on line four. Kathy in Kingston, you're on.
Hi. So my question is pretty simple compared to some of the other ones.
Good. You know, we can't hear it, though, Kathy. Are you on a bad phone, or...
Is that better?
Wow! That hurts my... when she yelled, it hurts my ears very... All right, go ahead. You're on. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm curious as to why when I drain pasta in my colander, to get all of the water out, I tip it sideways. Why doesn't it all just come out the bottom?
Finally, a mundane question that we can wrap our heads around. All right, boys.
Thank you.
That's terrible. I do exactly the same thing. I turn it to the side as well. I think it has to do with the fact that there's a lot of stuff at the bottom of the colander, and it blocks the water from being able to get out easily. For example, you put spaghetti in. or macaroni, I know, and it blocks the bottom to a good extent. So to get all the water out, you got to turn it to the side, because that's the direction the spaghetti pieces are sitting in. And so it slides off the spaghetti down the holes.
Yep, and if you have other shaped pasta, you've got to move it around to make sure that the channels all go the way the water can flow. So, yeah, I do the same, and shake it around.
Yeah, it's close packing is what it's called.
Yeah, you got to free up those holes and pour the water off the kind of the standing pools.
Now, here's something you could try is next time you try and pour the water off a spaghetti, for example, in a colander, first you put them in there, let it drain, and then shake it up and down, and then see how much more water comes out, and see if turning it sideways, then you still get more water.
So Kathy has a homework assignment.
Oh, I hope so.
You guys want to come over for spaghetti dinner?
Ah, you had me at spaghetti dinner, Kathy. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye now. Over to Chris in Hurleyville. Chris, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about instantaneous gas mileage and going up and down a hill versus around it. I used to have a car that had one of those instantaneous gas mileage readouts.
Yeah, me too.
And I would get, 30 miles a gallon at highway speeds on flat ground. But I would sometimes drive this place where I'd go way up a really big hill and then coast way down the other side. And I could just about take my foot off the gas, and it said I was getting 99 miles per gallon. But then the average gas mileage I was getting going up the hill and then coasting down was like above 50 miles a gallon. And is it possible you could actually get better gas mileage going up and down a hill rather than going the same distance on flat ground?
No.
I thought so. So my gas gauge was this thing was lying to me.
Yeah, probably. It probably maxes out it. I mean, when you're going downhill.
If you're going downhill further, I mean, if it's a longer downslope than an upslope.
Well, no, but you have to. One of the things that Ed and I believe in fervently is the law of conservation of energy.
Yeah.
So you've got to put the energy in to get up the hill. And you'll get that energy back coming down the hill, but you have to pay the friction tax. And you will always end up using more energy than you would have going on the flat.
You always got to pay the friction tax.
Plus, you got to go farther going up and down.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But the main problem is in a perfect frictionless universe, in which your car won't go then anyway, but you would use exactly the same amount of energy going up and down as you would flat. As a matter of fact, in a frictionless universe, you'd use no energy at all.
But this is taking a real-time average, though, right?
Yeah. Well, now we're talking about the accuracy of the sensors and all of that. You have to take the instantaneous mileage, I think, with a substantial grain of salt.
And the 99 miles per gallon, of course, is also is actually using no miles per gallon, no gallons.
No gallons per mile.
So it could be very much even higher.
So infinite.
Yes,
okay.
You're dividing by zero.
Chris, question.
Yeah, so I think it's primarily an instrument problem and that, no, you cannot get better mileage going up and downhill.
Okay, great. Let's go to Malcolm in Amherst, Massachusetts. Malcolm.
Hi, how do you do, folks?
Good, you're on.
Great. I had a question. It's not as much a question. I've been exploring two ideas, and I'll throw them out there real quick and see if the panel wants to deal with them or not. I basically been taking some a physics course, and I know this happens to people at times, and I don't want my head to get too far ahead of itself, but we kept using these equations and plugging various things in, like mass and finding velocities and all kinds of fun stuff, and we kept using time. He said, okay, well, you find the time here, and you put it in, you plug in the time, plug in the time, plug in the time. I started thinking about that. We keep plugging it in, even when we're trying to, say, find velocity, say. You're going to check the distance something has moved compared to t on the bottom, time. And so I was thinking, well, what is that? Every time we do that, aren't we basically looking at something moving? And so therefore, isn't time basically just observed motion? And when it's more accurate, you know, it works better for us, of course, as a measurement if it happens to be, you know, some kind of regular or predictable pattern. But that's more of a coincidence, that time is basically observed motion. That's kind of question number one.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing I was kind of wondering about, it back to the gravity and all that stuff, it seems like gravity is still somewhat of an unsolved mystery, yet I was reading up on the expansion of space. And it seems like, well, space really, like you said, is expanding in this kind of strange way where distances, especially between far objects, are increasing. And I even saw some number that was related to, you know, parsecs of space gaining, you know, meter or you know, a certain amount of more space, I guess it is, per amount of time, and that's what's accelerating. And so I wondered, why wouldn't that actually be what we call gravity, seeing as if these expansions are going on between objects, but also between the distances? Well, if you look at those objects in an infinite plane, that means that they're going to, the expansion's going to hit the other object on the other side as it comes around. So it just seems like it could be you know, the expansion of the universe itself could be responsible for gravity. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. Do you hear the crickets?
Yeah.
Gravity would work just the same way with or without the expansion of the universe. So
how do they know that?
Well, because gravity on large scales appears to be approximately the same as gravity on small scales. So the gravity, in the case of the solar system, for example, to some extent at least, is the same as the gravity of a galaxy, for example, except for this slight variation, which may be due to what they call dark matter or dark energy.
All right.
But weren't you folks just saying that it looks like there's actually a chance in some models work where, you know, you mess around with force and acceleration,
right,
and stuff, and these things change? So why wouldn't that possibly affect, you know, that, like we're saying, gravity at a longer distance would act different than a shorter distance?
It might very well, but there's no way to tell at the moment. We don't have the information to be able to determine that.
Jay, okay, we're going to let you go, Malcolm. Thank you very much for the call. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. This is another email question from Mark. My question is about the weather. If our atmosphere consists of warm air masses and cold air masses rubbing against each other, why do we not see lightning and hear thunder everywhere that there are air masses passing one another?
Well, lightning and thunder actually is caused by ice particles rubbing against each other to some extent, producing electron variability between the cloud and the surface of the Earth. So you have to have something that produces effectively the electron charge that allows it to occur. So it's not just because of cold and warm air masses rubbing against each other. There has to be humidity. There has to be updrafts and everything else to make it happen.
All right, let's go to the phones again, and I hope I pronounced this right. Stosh in Schenectady. Stosh, you're on.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, sorry. You guys are a little faint to me. My question is... it's a biology question, no physics, I swear. So as far as I know, the keratin makes up bird's feathers mostly, but also makes up human hair. And I was wondering, if there's birds with feathers that appear blue to our eyes, how come there's no people with naturally blue hair, at least so far as I know?
Stosh, I want to stop you. We only want physics questions on the program.
No.
Go ahead. Good question.
Great. Why? I mean, put it this way. I know a number of women who have colored their hair blue, and they don't seem to attract any more men than the ones that have regular hair.
Well, that's funny. They call that the Aunt B effect, as I recall.
Yeah.
No, so anyway, let's...
Okay. Hair color.
Yeah.
Hair color is caused by the melanin,
right,
tank that's in the hair. So that's actually absorbing light and changing the color.
Right.
My guess is that if bird feathers are like butterfly wing things,
you mean iridescence,
then it is in fact a physical effect of the way that the light is reflected off from layers of the keratin in the feathers. Now, it may be that there are blue compounds in there, but I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I'm just thinking that if somebody were to come along with blue hair, that it wouldn't necessarily be a survival trait.
Yeah.
While in the case of birds, having blue hair may turn on some very happy males.
Yeah.
And so that could be very simply an effect of blue hair begets blue hair.
In other words, a mutation at one point?
At one point, that turned out to be a positive mutation, and as a result, it becomes more common. But in the case of people tend to, humans tend to look at other things besides hair color for choosing a mate.
Yeah.
Okay.
But as far as the blue, there are relatively few good blue compounds in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Blue is a hard color to make. And that's why I think it's a physical effect, and hair is just as a different physical structure from feathers.
Well, that's a great question, Stosh. We appreciate that very much. David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job there.
Thanks.
My question is, with global warming, they said that the Northeast may be getting colder as a result of global warming because the ocean currents, which will be heated, will change direction, and the warming of the Northeast from these currents will cause the Northeast to become colder. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can tell you that a friend of mine who's been looking into this quite deeply has commented that if you look at a globe of the Earth, everything is red except the Northeast, and we seem to be getting colder rather than hotter. So basically, what's happened, I think, is that we have an observation, and we're trying to fit a model to it. And whether it's because of the ocean currents or because of something else is a good question. But we are getting colder here while everybody else is getting warmer.
Over a short period of time, though.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't call it climate change anymore.
Yeah, the ocean currents move a great deal of heat around. I've certainly seen the models are talked about where Europe could get colder if the Gulf Stream
were to stop.
Gets disrupted. Yeah, of the Northeast, I'm much less aware of the literature on that. But so because those currents are so important in moving heat around, messing with the currents is certainly going to change things.
David, thanks a lot for the call. I saw somewhere that El Nino may be making an appearance this year.
And that always throws a wrench into stuff.
Yeah. And so that will make us have a warmer winter? I can't remember.
Wetter winter, I believe.
A wetter winter? That's great. That's what I need is some more snow. What do you think? 2 minutes left. Let's take one more call. Let's go over to Bill in Saugerties. Bill, you have about 45 seconds to pose your question. Scientists have about 30 to answer.
Thank you very much for taking the call. Two quick questions. My understanding is at the beginning of the Big Bang, the universe expanded dramatically over a few seconds or milliseconds or billions of seconds. Isn't that faster than the speed of light, and how is that possible? That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, when you speak of the space-time continuum bending around black holes, are you referring to the actual vacuum of space or the particulate and electromagnetic material within the space? That's it.
Okay.
Well, the first question in terms of the Big Bang. Now I have to remember what the question was. What was the question?
The question was, it seems that it's expanded faster than the speed of light.
Okay. Well, the suggestion there is that during that first period of time, 10 to the minus 31 seconds and before, the physics laws did not hold effectively. And so Alan Guth came up with the idea of inflation to explain why everything in space seems to have exactly the same temperature. It seemed to have had an intimate contact with itself until it got very, very large.
Mm.
And again, whether it's true or not, we don't know. That's just what the model is.
Okay.
Voodoo physics. Thank you.
Exactly.
Bill, we're just about out of time, but thank you very much for the call. Well, that was an interesting one today, huh?
Yeah.
I think I could take up physics. That was great fun.
Amazing. You know, usually there is a physicist on board here very often, and you don't get any physics questions. Today, we got physics questions.
Well, that's because they knew we couldn't answer them.
Yeah, but you did so well. And thank you, Ed and Jim, for being here. Thank you at home for listening, and thank you for calling. Support comes from Planned Parenthood, Mid-Hudson Valley, for over 80 years, advocating for policies that will protect women's rights into the future. PPMHV.org for more information. Red Bud Development, collaborating with residential clients to design and build functional outdoor spaces that reflect the lifestyle. Red Bud Development.com. Manny's TV and Appliances, family-owned since 1977, now offering olive oil from his vineyards in Crete, available at Atkins, River Valley Market, Randall's, Foster's, and Big Y grocery stores, mannysoliveoil.com. And Shakespeare and Company, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting The How and the Why by Sarah Treem, a play about science, family, sex, and survival of the fittest, May 22nd through July 26th, shakespeare.org. All right, that's it. An exciting program. Head is spinning, but that happens. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to Barb King for answering the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, let's see, today's Thursday. Scientifically, tomorrow's Friday, so it'll be a food Friday. That's my theory.